This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news. To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, my guest this week is my colleague over at Yahoo Sports. We also see us on TV together over at NBC Sports Boston, Brian Scalabrine. What's up, Scal? Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. What is the advertisement deal this week? I'm gonna try to get some and never ever get like a follow up or anything. But what am I asking for this week that I'm not getting?
Well, I mean, this one I think I could deliver. It's an advertisement for Dan Patrick's new broadcasting school. So if you want to flesh out your skills, you know, in the off season,
that's the one thing I don't need.
We could send
probably do need it, but I don't have time to go to school, man. No. I only have time for my jobs.
Well, I mean, yeah, your jobs. You got the big three this summer. You don't have any days off.
You're good to go, man.
You're good to go. All right, appreciate you doing this, and of course, if you like this podcast, just support it by heading over to Apple Podcasts. Post a comment, leave a rating. Simple, easy, free. Best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. All right, Scal, you and I were both at the Garden on Sunday, and I think we both were pretty surprised at what we saw. The Celtics, they blow away the Cleveland Cavaliers in a game that was close for a few minutes early, got closer in that third quarter, but Boston in that first 68 seconds of the fourth really pulled away, and it was garbage time, you know, from 7 minutes on. Let's just start with the surprises. Surprises from Boston's end, surprises from Cleveland. What did you think?
So when you say surprises, like we've seen the Celtics overachieve all season, and we've also seen the Cavs underachieve. So maybe like in particular the timing of it, game one of the Eastern Conference Finals, but I didn't think going into this series that Boston is afraid. I think we're going to see more of the defense like Indiana, where they're up for the challenge and they think that LeBron is invincible, and less of the Toronto, where I didn't seem like that team was up for the challenge. So I wasn't surprised, but I would be surprised if it happened again. I'm fully expecting LeBron to be, you know, 34, 36 plus in game two, but that's still not, that doesn't mean that the Cavs are going to win. You know, it does seem, probably the most surprising is Celtics playing him one-on-one and him not completely dominating. That would probably be the most surprise. But Celtics handling their business, they've done their thing all season.
What was interesting about LeBron, and I'm not going to say it's surprising because we've seen it. I saw it as recently as game one of the Indiana series, is kind of what you alluded to there, the passivity of him in game one. And, you know, LeBron has said before, and he said it after the game, that you know, he treats game one as kind of a feel out. You don't necessarily get his best shot in game one. It's an incredible risk to take when you're you know, the road team in a 7-game series in a conference finals, but that's just how he operates. But there were a lot of switches, and we saw in the Toronto series, every time that LeBron got CJ Miles on his back, he took Miles to the basket. When it was Rozier, when it was Smart, when it was somebody other than Marcus Morris, what they switched off on, he just seemed to be looking to pass or looking to settle for a mid-range or a three-point shot. I don't know. I mean, look, it happened. Again, it happened in game one, and game two of the Pacers series, he came out and dropped, I think, 46 points in that game in a Cavaliers win. But it seemed to me like a pretty big risk to take not to be just at least aggressive, Scal. You know, go to the rim and create offense, try to do something to avoid your team getting slapped around.
Sure, but you have to understand, I could be wrong by this, and I'm only assuming based on what I know from LeBron. I think he kind of thought that game wasn't going to be the game that they were going to win early. He's not going to do this. I'm going to spend every ounce of energy out there to bring this team back from 20 just to end up being short. So I think he started conserving energy and sort of trying or experimenting on different things that he could use to see what's going to happen in game two. I do fully expect him to, right from the jump, to be ultra aggressive. And if the Celtics can get out to an early start once again in the TD Garden, they'll be in good shape for game two. But if it's a dogfight, a 25-25 game, right from the start, then you're going to get the best of LeBron. I thought he went into experimental and conservation mode very early in that game.
One thing about LeBron, too, is that just getting his best shot really doesn't guarantee anything for the Cavaliers anymore. I mean, that game, too, I mentioned against Indiana, he had the 46, but, you know, that Pacer team was a Victor Oladipo errant three from tying the game and maybe going to overtime and winning and going up 2-0 in that series. LeBron needs help, but he didn't really get it in game one there. You saw the as a team, Cavaliers shot like 15% from three. Mm-hmm. They were out-rebounded by Boston. Kevin Love was the second leading scorer, but he was only 5 of 14 from the floor. What'd you think of what the supporting cast for LeBron did in game one?
I don't look at the supporting cast the way I look at his old supporting cast, where you could throw the ball to Kyrie and Kyrie can go get you a bucket. I look at this supporting cast as guys who are supposed to play good off of LeBron. Kevin Love spacing the floor. If they do get a mismatch, they go down low. He had a nice play on Marcus Smart where he had that jump hook where he didn't even bring the ball down, but few and far between. I look at the supporting cast as not – if LeBron doesn't have it, if LeBron's not getting to the paint and compromising the defense, this team is not – it doesn't have enough to get over the hump. But if LeBron is playing what we expect him to play, a guy who's attacking the rim, relentless at going to the basket, you know, putting the officials in a position where they have to call fouls, whether it's offensively or defensively, when he does that – then that's when the rest of these guys will be at their best, because they need him to crack that free throw line, and he just didn't have that aggressiveness. And they will play better if he plays better.
Yeah, you know, Boston's defense got a lot of credit after game one. And look, they played well, but I thought the Cavs missed a lot of open shots. Like, there was, you know, a 10 or more of those three-point attempts that the Cavs were open on, and they just didn't connect on them. And, you know, LeBron said after the game, among other things, that – you know, if they got the same looks in game two, they were going to take them. I actually agree with them there that yeah. You know, if Boston plays the same way and you get the same looks, I don't think Korver is going to go 1-for-5 on those again. I don't think Love will go 1-for-4. J.R. Smith, I don't think he'll go 0-for-3. I think they'll make more of those shots in game two.
Yeah, to me, I don't look at a 25-point win by the Celtics. I look at it as they're up 1-0, and it's not cumulative here. It's just one game, and then you're moving into game two. And game two, because of LeBron's greatness, can unfold completely different than the way game one unfolds. So, yeah, I just think that it's going to have a very, very different feel. And even so, if it's a dogfight of a game, 48-46 at halftime, that game has a completely different feel. If Marcus Morris gets two fouls and they go at him in the post and he somehow – like has to take away his aggressiveness, that game has a different feel. Because when you're talking about the versatility of LeBron and the greatness and the brilliance of his play, you have to understand that one thing that happened in one game doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen in another.
You know, we mentioned Morris, and you know, those two early fouls he got, if Brad Stevens pulled him out, that changes the complexion of the game. Morris was a big part of that. And I asked Stevens about this after the game, and I loved his answer. He said he goes back to his playing days when it comes to guys having foul trouble. And he said he remembered being taken out of his own rhythm when he was pulled out of games with foul trouble. And he said 99% of the time he leans towards leaving the guy in the game. I don't think that's true, Scal, for, you know, like 90% of the coaches out there. I think 90% of the coaches out there, and look, this isn't like saying Brad Stevens is so smart. It's just that his philosophy is not one that's shared by a lot of coaches when it comes to guys with foul trouble. If Morris, who is defending a guy that can get you in a third foul very quickly, if Morris gets two fouls for any other team, any other coach, I think he's yanked out of there. And the way Morris played, if he is, that changed the entire complexion of the game.
Sure, and I think it's way more in-depth and complicated than that. If Morris gets yanked out of the game, it messes with your rotation throughout. Brad Stevens has a plan. If they come in with Tristan Thompson, I'm going to go with this guy. And then I'm going to toy with that lineup for about a minute, 30 seconds. And then I'm going to go Baines and go big versus big. But first, I want to use it. So is Morris getting the second foul? It screws up so much more than just saying, like, the guy was hot, which is like there's also some truth to that as well. You know, a guy is is he playing well? Is he not playing well? Can I trust him? Can I not? Another thing Brad is accustomed this whole season of guys, you know, having minute restrictions or guys missing games. So he has to kind of adjust on the fly with different lineups, no different than most NBA coaches. I just don't think that he's fearful of if Morris gets three fouls and I'm heading into the second half, or I'll put him back in and if he gets four, I can navigate around that later on. I want to stick with what's going and what's going well right now. So, you know, I think, you know, one thing you get to, you know, when you talk to Brad is he does question the NBA standard way of doing things. And it doesn't mean he always goes against it or against the grain. That's not true at all. He questions and says, well, is it right? And if it is right, why is it right? And what is a catastrophic event if it does go wrong? What could happen? And I just don't think that he kind of overreacts to, you know, the standard of, oh man, my superstar just got three fouls in the first half. What am I going to do? When you look, Morris finished the game with three fouls.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, look, Cleveland, we know, is going to play better. LeBron's not going to be a minus 32. He's not going to be as inefficient as he was in game one. But if I'm the Celtics and I'm watching back the film of this game, there are a lot of areas that I could play better too, or they could play better. I didn't think Jason Tatum played a great game. I thought he was good, but I thought he was good in spurts. I thought he was good in the second quarter. I thought he was good, I think, in the third, was it, when he went on kind of a run. But for other parts of the game, he was sort of invisible out there on the floor. His final stat line was good, you know, team high plus 27, but I didn't think he was great offensively in game one. Terry Rozier was not great offensively in game one, and we know what he's done all postseason long. So I think Boston can look back at this film and say, look, we won by 25, but, you know, we can play better. And on the offensive end of the floor, you know, two of our key guys, you know, weren't, you know, effective all game long.
Yeah, but I mean, they executed their game plan. They were low turnover, so they had good floor balance. So you didn't give a Cleveland team who's not a big running team, but an opportunistic running team. So I think in general, he did take one thing that he did and he provided is something that the Celtics are going to be missing without Kyrie Irving. Shot clock inevitably in the NBA is going to be running down with 7 seconds, 6 seconds on the clock, whatever. You're going to have a guy that can create his own shot. It can't always be ball movement, driving kick, driving close out, make the extra pass to a wide open shot. Like, everyone can't be the San Antonio Spurs, but they just need a guy. And Jason Tatum, for a rookie, to be dancing on the perimeter with a hesitation between his legs and then rise up and shoot a three right in the guy's face, like, that development doesn't happen for a player until year 7, year 8. And he's doing that as a rookie. Forget it. I don't even want to call him a rookie. He's doing that in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference Finals against some guys who Tristan Thompson has held his own against Steph Curry in an NBA Finals game, and he's doing that against him. It shows you, like, the growth and the maturity of what this guy could really become. But I'm with you in the sense I want to see Tatum cracking the free throw line, getting to the basket. I want to see him distributing the way that he did in that Philly series and also attacking the rim. Can he play better? Yeah. But if you're the Celtics offensively, I think you got to like what you did. You got to like the shots you got. And one thing that really stood out to me, they're not afraid of going at LeBron. From Jaylen Brown, Tatum, to Marcus Morris, these guys are not going to pull back. I think part of the game plan is wear LeBron out on the defensive end. Do not let him be free safety LeBron or middle linebacker LeBron, where he's calling out coverages and he's just zoning things out and not expending energy. You got to make him guard. That's how you negate LeBron on the other end, or how you give him body shots for a 7-game series.
Well, he still just takes plays off. I mean, you know, especially transition, getting back. I mean, there were a couple of glaring examples of that where he's just kind of walking back up the floor while his team is getting back in transition. And I think you're right. I think maybe the best way to defend him is to wear him down on the offensive end of the floor. Just keep grinding at him, whether it's attacking with the player he's guarding, or at the very least, kind of keep him in motion at all times. Don't let him take, you know, 24, 30 seconds off and get that in-game break in a game like that. But on your point on Tatum, and look, this is what I said, you know, months ago. I think Jason Tatum has the skill set to be like a 28, 30 point per game scorer in this league. I really do. Because his skills are obviously there. And he doesn't have his man strength yet, Scal. I mean, when he starts putting on some muscle, he's going to be able to go through guys. Right now, he can't. He's got to go around them, over them, you know, kind of use that up and under move that he has, use that length that he has. When he starts being able to kind of go through guys in the same way that, you know, a guy he's compared to, Paul Pierce, did in the middle of his career, he's going to be a special, special scorer.
Yeah. And the question would just be, like, within the system that the Celtics run, with all the way that they play, is that what's going to be needed or not? You know, there's a really strong 24 points a game where you're making, wow, look at that shot, or he saved the coach, or the coach didn't have to call a timeout on that play. And then there's, like, an empty, you know, 28, 29, 30, right? So, like, he probably falls into the – he's going to be have a good, solid, loud 24. And I'm with you. I think that he can continue to grow, even though for a rookie, and I think these three guys have, like, changed. And listen, everyone is – we're all analyzing the NBA, and we all base it off of our own perspective. But I didn't think that rookies played through contact very well. But Tatum, Mitchell, and Simmons, they initiate contact, and they play through contact better than, like, a six-year vet, a seven-year vet. I think that usually happens way down the road. Whatever these guys are doing as workout guys or a coach or in college, whatever they're doing is definitely working, because the skill level and the way that these guys are playing now has definitely elevated, even changed my whole opinion of what a rookie is capable of doing.
How crazy is it to you to see, you know, the all-star backcourt sitting at the end of the bench in that game? See Kyrie,
I know, right?
And Gordon. And honestly, you know, he doesn't get a lot of run, but throw in Daniel Tice there.
Yeah.
Because Tice was a huge part of what this team did for the first, a half plus of the season. I mean, it's wild kind of looking down the end of that bench and seeing what's going to be in the years to come.
But I don't, like, a lot of people, and I get it, like, the what have you done for me lately group in the NBA. But I look at that as, we are developing a championship caliber team, not a team that maybe can win, maybe they can get there, I don't know. This is, to me, we are right now developing a team that should win an NBA championship next year, you know, barring no one else gets hurt. You add Kyrie to the mix. You take his minutes from 33 down to 28. You take Gordon Hayward, you have him play less. You have these guys take the long-term approach. Everyone is in there. When they're in there, they're aggressive. They're sort of, you get the Al Horford at the 23 to 27 minute Al Horford, and somehow you're still winning close to 60 games. So I look at, with those two guys over there, just insert them with Brad Stevens, a full training camp to figure this whole thing out, and them being, I don't know if you'll ever be a title favorite with the Warriors assembled the way that they are, but a legitimate title contender. I would give them, hear me out, I'd give them more of a shot to win the title next year than I ever gave Cleveland this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, given how Boston plays against Golden State, and Houston for that matter, throw them into the mix, and with the talent around them. Let me finish on the Boston-Cleveland series with this. Game two, more important for Boston to win or Cleveland to?
So I think, because Boston won one, I think game two is irrelevant, to be honest with you.
Really?
I get it. Like, no matter what the outcome of two is, I don't think it's going to affect the series. I don't think, I'm like, Boston wins, I'm not saying Boston's going to win. I'm saying Boston's going to win in seven, because I'm sticking with my guns, right? But to me, it's not like a shoe-in. If Cleveland wins, to me, it's not a shoe-in that the Cavs are going to win this series. So I think because of Boston winning one, so obviously let's flip the script, right? If the Cavs won one, then it's a must-win for Boston, clearly, right? We all understand that. But because Boston held home court, it wouldn't surprise me at all if Boston takes two, Cleveland gets two, and we got this 5-6-7 matchup. Or if Cleveland splits and Boston gets one there. So I think game two, which is going to be compelling of a game because of LeBron and his back against the wall and pulling himself up from his bootstraps from being, you know, one of his worst performances, that's going to be compelling. But the outcome of this, the winner and the loser, is not going to dictate the series. At least at this point, I wouldn't say I'm more confident one way or another.
All right, Scal, hang on for a second. I've got to tell my listeners, and you, of course, because you want free stuff. This isn't free, but it's a pretty good experience, because this episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast is brought to you by Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting. Legendary sportscaster Dan Patrick, you know him from The Dan Patrick Show, Sunday Night Football, the Olympics, and of course SportsCenter back in the day, has teamed up with Full Sail University to offer an accelerated bachelor's degree in sportscasting. Full Sail University combines hands-on learning, immersive projects, and faculty with real-world experience to prepare students for life in the media industry. And for the Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, they've brought in some of sports media's best to be part of this program. Longtime ESPN producer and multi-Emmy winner Gus Ramsey is heading up the program, and sportscasting pros such as Sage Steele, Jay Harris, Bill Simmons, and many more are involved. Students will learn sportscasting inside and out, on camera, behind the camera, podcasting, radio, interviewing, and everything in between. At Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, you can earn a bachelor's degree in about half the time, as short as 20 months. And you can choose to earn your degree online or on Full Sail's campus in Orlando, Florida. To learn more about Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, go to fullsail.edu/Mannix. All right, let me move on to a team that was just recently vanquished. The Toronto Raptors exits in the second round, a four-game sweep to the Cavaliers. The fallout is that Dwayne Casey has been fired as the head coach of the Raptors. Put together a terrific seven-year run in Toronto, as you know, advanced deep into the playoffs a couple of times, but just couldn't get past LeBron James. And you know, for the third consecutive season, LeBron and the Cavaliers eliminated them. What did you think of the decision to fire Dwayne Casey in Toronto?
So the only thing that makes sense to me on this one is that Toronto was looking to hire Budenholzer. Like, I don't see, I get it on the NBA. Things happen and there's expiration dates on coaches' careers and all that stuff. But, you know, I thought they had a really good season. I thought they were a really good team. It would be interesting if they would have called that flagrant foul on Kevin Love, and if they would have won game one or tipped the ball in won game one, how the Toronto-Cleveland series would have unfolded. But, you know, the reality is it's a what have you done for me lately business. So I get why something like that happens. But I think if I'm – let's just say I'm Toronto and I want to make a move without – like disrupting my team or dismantling or rebuilding or whatever, all the other ways that you can, you know, try to make a move for your with your roster. I think that going out there and getting Mike Budenholzer, who also got swept by LeBron, by the way, because he's a really great player, I think it's probably a move that they're feeling like it can, like, insert some life. Because clearly Toronto, and I'm not going to blame Dwayne Casey for this, Toronto in that series, I don't think that they believed that they can beat LeBron and the Cavs.
That's the biggest part of it for me, and I'll get to Budenholzer in a second. But, you know, after game one, and I don't really blame Casey for game one. I mean, you go to the end of regulation, they had four chances, you know, in the paint to hit game winners. And, you know, are you supposed to scheme that? I mean, can you tell Valanciunas to tip it a little bit further to the left? I mean, they were just bunnies. The rim just seemed to have a lid on it in that moment. And does the series of the complexion of the series change if they win that game one? Maybe they don't get dusted in game two. And even if they do, are they able to play better? Look, they went into Cleveland and played a great game in game three. You know, neck and neck on the Cavaliers' home floor. And LeBron just made another great play. But I'm with you. There were a couple of times in game two and certainly all of game four that team just looked dispirited. And if you're the head coach, that's your responsibility. I think that you can get into the schematic stuff, like not being able to take the ball out of LeBron's hands at the end of game three. You know, Casey said that was the plan, but they didn't execute it properly. You know, some of that's on the head coach. The decision to bench DeMar DeRozan. Well, what did you think of that decision, by the way, to bench DeRozan in game three?
Well, it clearly worked. Like, they came back.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think you have to find a way to get them on the floor. And, you know, and in today's day and age with players, and this is something like this, like, the game is changing quick. It's changing fast. And everyone's got to jump on board. You want players that are versatile offensively, players that you can have the ball in your hands and make a play. Also, players that can play off the ball, catch and shoot. Play off the ball, drive a closeout. You want all that. You just don't want one-dimensional players anymore. And DeRozan, who I thought this year expanded his game a little bit, He's not – if you have something going, something working, and you put him out there and he can't shoot a three or he's not confident with it, then it sometimes it can disrupt what you're doing. Now, if DeRozan was a 40% catch-and-shoot, wide-open shooter, there's no question he would have been in there. But he's kind of a he's a big-time scorer with the ball in his hands. If he goes in the game, can you really play differently? So I get why KC did that, but I think the focus should be – with DeMar DeRozan is I got to become a better off-ball player. And when I become a better off-ball player, there's no way I'll ever be put in that situation again. And that's the name of the game nowadays. You can be a 35-point-per-game scorer. You can score 50 on any given night with a ball in your hands. But on the nights when you don't have it, can you go to the side and hang out in the corner and wait for the ball to come to you? Can you come off a flare screen and make the defense react to you because you're, you know, a 40% shooter from three? And because that the game is changing, like, players have to change along with it. And if you get stuck into this, nah, that's not who I am, then I think you're going to get left behind and get put in situations like that. So I would hope that Casey could figure out a way to make him a better player off the ball. But it doesn't seem like he's adjusted to that. He's getting better. And he still has some ways to go. But until you're versatile offensively, it's going to be really tough to be, a big-time team in this league.
I think a big part of this that people have to remember is that Masai Ujiri didn't hire Dwayne Casey. He came in after Casey was there. And look, I think when Masai came in, he anticipated at some point earlier than this being able to hire his own coach. But, you know, Casey kind of blew that up by winning and getting to the conference finals a couple of years back and succeeding maybe more than Masai thought he was going to succeed early on. So I think this was kind of a long time coming, and this was just sort of the breaking point, the third straight loss to Cleveland in the conference finals. And if you're Masai, you've got to be looking at this roster saying, look, I can probably make a deal, but does a deal for DeMar DeRozan right now bring back anything that's going to help me in the short term? And they've got a lot of guys on that roster that you've got to start thinking short term with. I mean, Kyle Lowry, probably a couple more years that you can maximize his value on the floor. Serge Ibaka, I mean, he's listed at 28, but God knows. Like, you know, the he's been hot and cold out there at times. You know, you've got to find a way to maximize this group. And sometimes, look, a coaching change can make the difference. No, I don't know. Remember back in, what was it, like the early 2000s when Rick Carlisle was let go in Detroit. And I don't know if that team wins a championship with Rick Carlisle, but they did with Larry Brown. And maybe that's what Masai's thinking to some degree, that if I bring in a Budenholzer or somebody else, that coach can take this group and harness it in a way that will make us more successful.
Sure. And sometimes just a change of scenery is gonna be fine for people. And I said that on my show this morning on NBA Radio, Sirius XM 206. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey, kid, chill away, my friend.
A little plug.
When does
right?
the Big Three start?
The Big Three starts on June 22nd, day after the draft in Houston. But I said this morning, it's one of those things where you better hope you get Budenholzer. Budenholzer to me, so what we hear is Masai Ujiri is all about ball movement. He's always been about ball movement, player movement. And that's what Budenholzer was all about. I'm not saying he started this trend, but he sort of early mastered the trend with that Atlanta team. Like I said, but once again, did get swept by LeBron. But if they're going that direction, yeah, I think Budenholzer's the guy, and I can see why. You know, like, all right, fine, we're gonna just mix it up. We know that Casey's a good coach, just like Detroit knew Carlisle was a good coach. But we're gonna try to get Larry Brown, just like they're gonna try to get Budenholzer. But if Budenholzer goes to Milwaukee, then what does that – I mean, you tell me who's – I mean, maybe it's an assistant coach. I would assume it has to be, for a team like that, somebody that can make that move. But you tell me, like, who else is out there that they're going to end up getting that's an upgrade to a guy like Dwayne Casey, who, by the way, was like the defensive maestro on that Dallas team that beat LeBron way back when in 2011.
Yeah, he had the scheme that did it, and so he's capable of doing it. I don't know who it is. If it's not Budenholzer, I mean, you hear a name like Nick Nurse, who is one of the architects of that revamped offense, is considered a pretty bright offensive mind, and that's really what I think the Raptors are going for with their next coach. I mean, Budenholzer, as you said, you know, the ball movement stuff. He's a very, very good strategist, offensive strategist. So I can see them going, you know, to Nick Nurse as a backup. But if you're Budenholzer, is there a clear better job there? I mean, Milwaukee has the better player. I mean, Milwaukee has the 23-year-old phenom that you can build around for years to come. But, you know, do they have, you know, other pieces to that puzzle? I mean, is Jabari Parker come back? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I like the Milwaukee job more than I like the Toronto job because you do have
long term. Yeah,
but either way, I mean, I just think if you're Toronto, my whole point is if you're Toronto and you get rid of Casey, then you better have someone in the pipeline. And I think that's Budenholzer, and I think he'll take the job. But the Milwaukee job to me just sounds like a better job. I mean, that new arena.
Well, why would he take it? If you know, our old colleague there, Adrian Wojnarowski, reported on Monday that, you know, those two teams are starting to jockey for him. If they both want him, why would Budenholzer take the Toronto job?
Yeah, I would take the Milwaukee job. Like, let's play devil's advocate and figure out a good way of reason why. What do they have over? I don't know. I can't think of any
really
reason
not a lot.
Why you
I
would
mean,
you would take Toronto's a better city than Milwaukee. There yeah. you go. There's one.
But Milwaukee's got that brand new arena opening next year. New
I
practice
like Milwaukee.
Facility.
I ain't gonna lie. I just cause you know, like Toronto's cold doesn't feel as bad as Milwaukee's cold. It just seems like an opportunity to coach Giannis would. I don't know why any coach would ever pass that up.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, it seems like it's a no brainer for him to take the Bucks job. Another guy in Toronto they might want to look at is Jerry Stackhouse because they've had an up close and personal kind of look at him, you know, over the last couple of years. I don't know much about Stack other than what I hear. He apparently, you know, has, you know, developed a reputation as a no nonsense type of guy. You know, team's been impressed with how he's run his offenses. But again, that's a pretty big risk to take. I mean, Stack has only been an assistant coach for a few years. Do you really hand over the franchise, a team that's in desperate need of leadership with this group, to a guy that's as unproven as Jerry Stackhouse?
I would not be afraid of hiring Jerry Stackhouse, to be honest with you. A guy who's been around the NBA for a while and has proven I heard he's a big-time worker. And that's sometimes like – that's like the knock on former players when they become coaches is they don't put in the work they need to, the film work. But that's not what we heard from Stackhouse. He's tough on the guys. He demands a lot from them. So, but the one thing is, if they don't hire Stackhouse, it would be interesting because they do have an up close and look with him, right? They've seen him with their G League team, and so if they don't hire him, I don't know what that says. But from all the stuff I hear out there, Stackhouse is a great coach.
Yeah, I've heard good things. But it's also worth noting that, you know, a lot of jobs have been filled and he hasn't been tapped for any of them. Now, I think Orlando is still a possibility. Jeff Weltman, who's running things down there, used to be up in Toronto, so we'll see there. But he's still unemployed as of, or at least employed still in the G League at this moment. All right, let me finish with this, Scal. The Sixers, they were gentlemen sweep out of the playoffs by Boston. And now, you know, they look ahead to a pretty important offseason. I thought it was interesting that Brett Brown, at his exit interview, he said that this team, and I'm paraphrasing here, needed a high-profile free agent, needed to bring somebody in into this mix. What does that team need? You got a good look at them for five games over the last couple of weeks. There's obviously a natural development that has to take place, right? You need, you know, Ben Simmons to jump to another level. Embiid, his conditioning is going to be paramount this offseason. But what kind of player does that team need to make that jump?
To get to a championship level?
Yeah, I mean, that's the next step,
LeBron,
right?
LeBron, Kawhi, Kevin Durant.
Whatever, all this stuff coming out of Philadelphia. And maybe it comes true, and if it does, I'll eat crow on this one. But, like, Philadelphia plans to pursue LeBron and Kawhi. Like, okay, I want a pony. Like, that's to me is what, that's
you
what
want
it feels
a unicorn.
Like. Yeah, I mean, like, okay, so doesn't every team in the league. Like, can we start, like, do you want me to call, like, Weltman and Hammond down to Orlando?
But see, you got to back up a little bit because, like, they have the assets. They have the Laker pick, right?
Right.
If it, like, Boston's
getting that, right? Once
the ball's bounced and it bounces towards the Sixers, they now own that pick.
Yeah.
So, if we ask our boy Shams, what's his last name? I don't want to mispronounce
Sharania,
it.
There you got it. Shams Charania.
Shams Charania. If you ask him, like, everything is hunky-dory in San Antonio, and oh, Kawhi Leonard's misunderstood. But I don't know, man. It seemed like to me that there could be some movement going on there. If I was San Antonio, I wouldn't want to get rid of him. And what is the price? Is it going to be, you know, the eighth pick in the draft, the 10th pick in the draft? Is that enough? And, you know, something else. So, yeah, like Kawhi Leonard, if you can go out and make that move, you would do it. You can also, you know, I'm sure Philly can give future stuff up. I don't know what other assets they have. But, of course, you want to, like, they need, if they want to win, they need, like, a Kawhi Leonard for sure. And that's the difference between a Kawhi Leonard is you have to trade for him. LeBron, you can get him for free. He can come as a free agent. So I don't get if any organization out there, if you can get LeBron without giving up assets, you have to do it. There's no reason to ever turn down LeBron James, and you don't have to give up people. Now, you want to have the conversation about assets and players and future picks, you can have that conversation, and teams have to adjust to that. But LeBron as a free agent – giving nothing up, that would be, it's a no-brainer. You do it.
Do you think that Markelle Fultz is going to recover from this year?
I don't know if he will. He might. I just don't know if the Sixers. I know this. We talked about Jason Tatum. Like when you tank and you're bad, that's one thing. You have to pick the right guys along the way. But if they pick along the way, if they pick Jason Tatum, somehow, some way, they just traded up and then took Tatum. Let's just say that, you know, the information out there and whatever. How bad would it be right now for the rest of the Eastern Conference? If they had Ben Simmons, Embiid, and Tatum in the pipeline, and then they're having the Laker pick, and they would still have cap space next year. Are you kidding me right now? So along the way of tanking, you have to get it right. So can the Sixers recover from this? Sure. LeBron goes there, they could recover from this. But I can't guarantee what LeBron's going to do, but I would feel that if LeBron saw Jason Tatum on the Sixers with Ben Simmons and Embiid, I don't see how he would pass that up.
I mean, take it one step further. Kristaps Porzingis.
But then you have to start looking at if they had Porzingis, would they have gotten Ben Simmons, right?
Yeah,
because then they would have
been
good, right? Yeah. Then they would have been like the eighth pick in the draft. So you can't
would they? I mean, remember, Okafor was like productive his first year, right? I mean, he played. I think he had like 17 or something.
Yeah, but they were like the worst team in the NBA.
But would Porzingis, like you draft Porzingis instead of Okafor, does he make them that much better as a rookie like that Okafor did?
Well, they were the worst team in the NBA. I mean, they're the worst team ever.
Look, I'm just saying, like, it's not like you know, you draft Embiid and he doesn't play, and then
no, but that's Chris. That's ignoring something that you know. Like, if we had a different conversation and we were talking about Okafor, you would destroy him on how the game has changed because he can't keep up with the speed.
Yeah,
he couldn't keep up with the speed then. He just happened to score a bunch of points.
Yeah,
and I know you know that. But you're like using stats as a saying like, he was really good. No, he was never good, but he got stats. And now he's not good and not playing, right? It's like a big difference.
No, look, all I'm saying is I don't know that in 1 year,
that much of a difference.
In 1 year, would he have made that much? I mean, they were in full on, they were still tanking at that point. I don't know how much of a difference.
Sure. Well, if they did that, then, they would have been better the following year because they would have had Dario Saric. I mean, like this team.
Yeah, right.
You can't go down that road, yeah. Right? But anyway, we know for a fact that they had an opportunity to either sit on their pick and take Tatum or at three and force the Celtics to do something or, you know, kind of make the move that they made. And then when they made that move, they could have took Tatum and they didn't. And my point of all of this is in the tanking process, you better get it right, or else you're like throwing seasons away for nothing.
Yeah.
You're throwing seasons away for what are you getting in return? Nothing.
Yeah, I don't know where they go. One thing I would say Philadelphia should do, I don't know who you think the best NBA shooting coach is out there. I'll use Chip Englund as an example. He's pretty good. If you're the Sixers, don't you go out there and like offer the NBA's best shooting coach like $2 million and an associate head coach title to come there and work with your guys? Because you have two former number one picks that cannot shoot the basketball.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you want the very best, whoever that is, The very best. Remember Dave Hopla back in the day? Remember his?
Yeah.
I heard Dave Hopla.
Whoever it is.
I went to Dave Hopla's camp.
Whoever that guy is, you got to hire him.
You go hire that guy. I mean, am I wrong? Like, don't you, is it that too simplistic? Because you got two guys that can't shoot. So if and when they can shoot, they have the potential to be great players. So why not bring in the best shooting coach out there?
I mean, I don't know if it's that easy. You know, okay. Like, you know, I've worked with shooting coaches and, you know, like, I think more than anything, it's probably a mental thing. And, you know,
Simmons, his shot, like, I had Kobe on the radio show. I had Kobe. Caron Butler booked him. So we had Kobe on the radio show last weekend. And Kobe was like, look, if I was advising Ben Simmons, I'd say throw that shot in the garbage, basically. And I'm paraphrasing him there, but
start all over.
Like, because that's a broken jump shot.
Yeah, a lot of people think he's going to go back to his right hand or I don't even know if he was doing that. Like, no, but it's just, it's one of those things. To me, he doesn't have to be a great shooter to be effective. He doesn't. But he does have to master the 8 foot to 10 foot shot to be. Like in the MVP conversation, not next year, but somewhere down the line. The idea, yeah, I get it. I don't think Ben Simmons ever has to take wide open threes to become that type of player. I think he's such a good passer and he's a good finisher when he gets all the way to that restricted area, but he also has to be able to be good right outside that restricted area. So before you go into the jump shot world and you have Ben Simmons taking a bunch of jump shots and missing them, experimenting along the way, I would work on extending out that, you know, his layup range per se, the floater with the right hand, left hand. I would take baby steps.
I agree with you, but I mean, can't you walk and chew gum at the same time? Like, don't you want him in the gym? You know, if he is going to break down that jump shot, I mean, I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but Kawhi Leonard did it. Like, he came into the pros with a busted jump shot. They changed it. He became one of the best shooters in the NBA. Not to say that Simmons can follow that exact same path, but, you know, break it down, build it back. I mean, I think he should aspire to be a like 35% 3-point shooter.
Oh no! Well, along the way, there's going to be some like carnage along the way. You're going to lose some tough games, and people are going to look at you like you're going to have. You think Embiid doesn't run back on defense now? What are you going to do when Simmons pulls up from three off the dribble? You're going to be like, man, are you kidding me right now? So I could see. Listen, he's special at those other things. Refine where you're special and improve slightly. Like start with a fadeaway. But I still think he needs to get better at shooting floaters just outside that restricted area. Yeah. That's an area in which I think he can get to anytime he wants. So forget the jump shot. You can sag off him. He'll drive the ball. If he can get really good at those floating shots, those runners, those are the ones that are going to be impossible to stop.
All right, Scal, I appreciate you joining me, man. Thank you.
You got it, man. See you.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Brian Scalabrine for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.